at 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, you're going to be hearing a conversation that I recorded with best-selling author Jacqueline Tobin, who is probably best known for an earlier book titled Hidden in Plain View, a secret story of quilts in the Underground Railroad, in which she suggested that some people involved in the Underground Railroad would actually use quilts and the display of quilts to communicate important coded messages to those they were trying to help. In the book we're going to be talking about today, From Midnight to Dawn, Jacqueline Tobin explores what amounted to the last leg of a very long journey for certain American slaves who would actually find their way from the South and from captivity all the way to communities in Canada. The book is titled From Midnight to Dawn, The Last Tracks of the Underground Railroad, a book published by Anchor. This is a conversation we recorded back in 2008.
You mentioned, I think maybe in the preface or introduction to the book, that the story of these communities in Canada, made up almost entirely of former slaves, is a story that has been almost completely untold, unknown in America, and you say until recently, even in Canada, a largely untold story. For any particular reason?
Well, certainly in America, I think that we have a tendency to believe our history begins and ends at our borders. In terms of Canadian history, what I've come to learn is that the black population in Canada is such a minority that many people don't even know that they have a long history in their country. So I think those two factors combined on both sides of this international border.
Is there any particular reason that you came to know about this?
Well, it was actually while I was doing research for Hidden in Plain View that I had a wonderful African-American gentleman call me up and say, "Have you ever been to Buxton?" And I said, "No, I don't know where Buxton is." And he said, "Well, it's in Ontario, Canada." And he said, "You must go to Buxton." And I didn't make it there for several years. It was actually after publication of Hidden in Plain View that I finally got up there in the year 2000. And I went up there over Labor Day weekend when they were celebrating their welcoming home. It's called Homecoming, and it's a welcoming home of the descendants of all these former slaves that return to Buxton every year to celebrate their heritage. And I was so astounded by what I was learning about their heritage and their story that not only was I intrigued enough to want to write about it, but I've been going back there for 7 years, every year on homecoming. I now consider it part of my homecoming as well.
Tell us again exactly where Buxton is.
If you cross over into Canada from Detroit and you go over into Windsor, you can go straight up about 60 miles and you will hit the town of Chatham, and you will also about 12 miles away hit the small community of North Buxton. Buxton was actually divided into North and South Buxton eventually. And you will then go, you can go to the west and you can also come up upon the community of Dresden, which was once near the black settlement called Dawn.
In fact, let's take this moment to explain the title of your book. I mean, this is just wonderful. Again, the title is From Midnight to Dawn. tell our listeners exactly what that title means, besides the poetic beauty of it.
Well, I was very fortunate to come up with such a title. It just exactly fit, and it hit me when I was driving across the country one day, and I said, oh, my goodness, this is the title for the book. So that's always exciting to a writer when this happens. But in this case, Midnight was the code name for Detroit on the Underground Railroad. And Dawn, as I just mentioned, was the name of a black settlement near the community now known as Dresden that was settled by blacks up in Canada. So you have this poetic name, and which can, of course, be read on many levels, from Midnight, Detroit, across the international border into Canada towards Dawn, the advent of a new life, a new beginning, but also the name of a black settlement in Ontario.
Fascinating. So let's dig into some of the specifics of this story. First of all, briefly, we should talk about how the situation for slaves in America kind of changed over the course of the years, and certain attitudes began changing, certain laws began to be enacted, fugitive laws and the like, which really changed day-to-day life for slaves and sort of reshaped their attitudes about it and whether or not it made sense for them to attempt an escape. Just talk a moment about that.
Well, I think there were a couple of things, and what I had to ask myself was, why Canada? Why, how did Canada end up becoming the land of Canaan, if you will, for fugitive slaves? And in this case, what we find out is that Great Britain, Canada was then called British North America before the Civil War. Great Britain had already abolished slavery in 1833. As a little side, we are this year, this month actually, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the ending of the slave trade in Britain. And for those of your listeners who want to find out more about that, I really urge them to go see this amazing movie out telling that story, and it's called Amazing Grace, which should be in your theaters right now, if I'm not mistaken.
But I think that's right.
It tells the story of how these wealthy, influential men banded together and tried to end the slave trade. And it was absolutely revolutionary for them to do or even to consider such an idea, because historically slavery had always been a part of various cultures around the world. So for them to actually force this issue and create this movement, this anti-slavery movement, was huge, but it began in Britain. Britain at the time, of course, was also the largest slave trading country, so it makes sense that there would be someone who would finally realize that this was necessary to end such an institution. In the United States, though, what happened to eventually start pushing more and more blacks to try to reach freedom in Canada was about, I would suggest that it was the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. And this was an act that allowed slave owners to actually cross over into northern states, which had already abolished slavery for the most part, and go try to recapture those slaves that had escaped and bring them back to the South. And this was now provided by law. They now had the support of law to go after their former slaves. So it was no longer safe for blacks to just reach freedom in the north part of the U.S. They now had to actually cross an international boundary, that international border, and into what we now know as Canada, if they were to at least be supported by legislation that allowed them to live freely.
I think we should mention something else, which is sort of a sad thing or regrettable thing to mention, but I think it's very helpful to our really comprehensive understanding of this. You talk in the chapter about the community of Wilberforce in Canada, about what attitudes were like in Ohio in the 1820s and 1830s. And some of what you talk about resonates very powerfully with attitudes with which we're living very much today. Tell us what life was like in Ohio in the early part of the 19th century, and what it meant for the blacks who fled there.
Well, what you're referencing is the fact that Ohio had already abolished slavery in 1802. So you had this state that was, by law, a free state, but it's also bordering across the river with a slave state, the state of Kentucky. So you had a lot of escaping slaves trying to reach freedom in Ohio. You saw a mass influx of blacks moving into the state of Ohio, particularly the Cincinnati area. And what began happening is Ohio got very nervous about this mass influx of immigration. And as you suggested, many of the lessons that we discover, all the different trials and tribulations that were occurring up north with these newly freed black people up in Canada, there are similar lessons that are still going on with us today. So I find that fairly ironic, and you touched on that. But in Ohio, what the legislature considered doing is they started enforcing black codes, which were very, very harsh restrictions put on even free black people in Ohio in order to try to control them, because they began to be so worried about the influx of these fugitives into their state. Well, the free blacks in Ohio banded together as it made sense to do so, and tried to protect themselves. But when they began seeing the writing on the wall that with the escalating pressure on them and escalating threats of violence, in some cases certainly violence, what they did is they sent certain delegates into Canada and said, is there land for us to buy up there that we could move and become a part of a free country and live freely without these threats up there? Well, the people of Cincinnati didn't wait for the folks to come back. They actually began the mob violence, and what happened is you saw an outflux of certain groups of blacks outside of the Cincinnati area, and some of those same folks ended up in Canada and began a community, the first black settlement, called Wilberforce.
You tell us about that terrible event, that mob violence in 1829 in the summer. 3 days of violence directed against the black community, and over 1,500 African Americans end up really fleeing for their lives. I'm so struck by a quote you shared with us from a fugitive slave named John Malvin, and he writes, "I thought upon coming to a free state like Ohio that I would find every door thrown open to receive me. But from the treatment I received by the people generally, I found it little better than Virginia." I mean, it's sobering indeed. And we get so sad when we think about a former slave freeing from the South, fleeing from the South, hoping to find welcoming arms, and not finding that kind of welcome at all, at least in this pocket of the North.
Well, and you also find a new definition of freedom now being demanded by those formerly enslaved blacks who did find freedom under the law, at least. They were now demanding freedom of equality and opportunity. And this was something that white people, even in the North, got very nervous about. It was one thing to free formerly enslaved people, but to give them the same opportunities and the same equality under the law was something they hadn't quite accepted yet. So the whole definition of freedom was becoming more expansive at this same particular time.
That brings to mind another interesting shift mentioned in the same chapter, I think. You talk about how African Americans in the early 19th century still very much thought of themselves as Africans. And that there was even a group, I think, called the American Colonization Society, which really existed, I think, to hopefully repatriate some of these slaves or freed slaves back to Africa. Before too long, that became something that most of the blacks here in North America weren't really interested in being returned to the continent of Africa.
And what you're referring to here is the American Colonization Society, which was begun by people such as Henry Clay on one end of the spectrum and Bushrod Washington, nephew of George Washington, thought that, well, maybe we can do away with this whole threatening issue of slavery if we just try to repatriate these Africans back to Africa. Well, they established the country of Liberia in 1817, but shortly after that, blacks started seeing themselves and identifying themselves more as Americans and did not want to be repatriated. And so this whole huge issue of immigration versus being immigrated took on huge connotations in the black community.
Hmm.
And there were great arguments on both sides of the spectrum, some believing that, yes, it was good to go out and find a new place to live in another country, perhaps our motherland of Africa. Others said, no, I am American. I have been here now for our families have been here for three or four generations, and I consider myself an American.
Well, and in your book, a freed slave in the North is quoted as saying, many of our fathers and some of us have fought and bled for the liberty, independence, and peace which you now enjoy. Surely it would be ungenerous and unfeeling in you to deny us a humble and quiet grave in that country which gave us birth.
Absolutely. And again, I can go back into the first precedent we see of people moving into Canada actually began at the end of the American Revolution. And this began because the British, during that conflict that we were having with this country called Great Britain at the time, were using a military tactic. They were saying, okay, if you escape, or they would actually free slaves of lands in the South that they would capture, and they said to these newly freed blacks, if you fight for us, we will give you your freedom. Well, this was a military tactic and not necessarily on any belief in anti-slavery upon the British at that particular time, but they used it as a military tactic during the American Revolution to impact the manpower being used by especially the southern states. So we saw that tactic. Now, what's interesting about that tactic as a little side here is that Abraham Lincoln used that same tactic later on during the Civil War when he offered the Emancipation Proclamation, which did not, contrary to popular opinion, free all the slaves. It actually only freed those slaves in those states that were threatening to secede from the Union. So it was more a military tactic at that point by Lincoln than it was benevolence on his part.
Hmm. That's one of the most interesting shades of this story, isn't it? That sometimes maybe evil things were done, not always for evil reasons, sometimes just out of plain fear, and sometimes good things were done for not the most impressive or laudable of reasons. I mean, there is so much gray in the story of how the early United States of America lived with the institution of slavery.
Well, and again, I keep coming back to this whole concept of these British abolitionists, these first British abolitionists like William Wilberforce, and beginning to understand just how revolutionary this concept of abolishing slavery really was at this time in history.
Hmm.
Because down through history, cultures had always enslaved those that they had captured and given them some form of indentured servitude or slavery. But it wasn't really until we began bringing a particular group of people, and those were the black people from Africa, over into our North and South American and Caribbean areas, that we began to see the color line in this whole issue of slavery. And that's when it took on a whole different tone than it used to.
I think ahead of us talking briefly about a couple of these specific settlements, I think we should also maybe remind people of this thing called the Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. which of course helped to facilitate escaping blacks, escaping slaves, helped them, facilitated this journey from the South all the way to perhaps Canada for some of them. that we should not think of the Underground Railroad as more or less than actually what it was. I mean, this is not what we sometimes tend to think of as a highly organized system. I mean, it was loosely organized, if it was organized really at all, and yet it was the lifeline upon which so many slaves depended.
Well, and I'm glad you're trying to help redefine that, because scholars in the past 20 years have certainly come to understand that this Underground Railroad, this idea of the Underground Railroad that certainly I grew up with, of these benevolent white people helping these poor slaves escape, that's what I call the romantic version of the Underground Railroad, when in essence I now try to speak of the Underground Railroad as a resistance movement that began when the first chains were put on blacks in Africa, and resistance took many forms, and one of those forms was escape. And again, contrary to popular opinion, they weren't just waiting on plantations, waiting to be saved by benevolent white people.
Right. You say, when an underground railroad was laid on the paths first trod by courageous forebears who had escaped without any white assistance, many of the conductors, so-called conductors of that underground railroad, were free blacks. Elsewhere in the book, I think in the preface, you say, what has come to be known as the Underground Railroad was less an organized system than a corridor of subterfuge and chance. There was no easy path out of slavery to freedom. For a few of them, of course, they did indeed find their way to Canada, and one of the first such communities settled was called Wilberforce. Ultimately, I guess we would say not a successful community, in that it really didn't live on. It died out for maybe a mix of reasons, and yet you say this is an important name in this whole movement and was a symbol of hope for many blacks.
It absolutely was, because when you consider the definition of success, I'd like to redefine it when we talk about Wilberforce. This was absolutely the first black settlement to be instituted by blacks themselves for their own freedom, which I think is an important, it was self-determination at its best, saying we are going to determine our and control our futures. We are going into Canada. We are going to establish a community. So that the failure of success of Wilberforce is not whether it succeeded and lived on forever, but that it existed at all. And not only that, but that abolitionists throughout the world looked at Wilberforce and said it can be done. And they were looking at it as a symbol of what blacks could do for themselves. So this was huge symbolically for those who desired freedom.
By the way, we should mention that it was Quakers in Ohio and Indiana who stepped forward with the thousands of dollars necessary to purchase this land up in Canada. I mean, the Quakers, time and time again in our history, can be lauded for such generosity.
Well, not just in the U.S. and Canada, but also in that British movement, which worked to abolish the slave trade in Britain. They also, the Quakers were also involved in that first anti-slavery movement very strongly with both action and financial support. So, yes, the Quakers have been the backbone of this whole movement from the beginning.
As we read about some of these other communities in Canada, one of the things that, of course, is really striking is that famous names come to the fore. I mean, names like author Harriet Beecher Stowe, for instance. Tell us why her name figures so prominently in the pages of this particular chapter.
Well, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote that marvelous book called Uncle Tom's Cabin, and it was Abraham Lincoln who actually, upon meeting Harriet Beecher Stowe, said, "So you're the little lady who started this Civil War." He actually credited her with instigating whites up north, which she absolutely did with publication of that book. However, when she published the book, she was also attacked from all directions, attacked to the point where she actually had to write almost like a rebuttal, and called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she tried to prove all the different people, prove about the people, about the places, about the characteristics she was giving her characters. And upon reading the character of Uncle Tom, she actually suggested that it was certainly a composite character of blacks that she had met. But one of the blacks she suggests had a lot to do with her Uncle Tom character was a man that actually began the Dawn Institute, a formerly enslaved person who self-emancipated himself and his family, and his name was Josiah Henson. So here we have a character in a book by the name of Uncle Tom, who actually was based in large part on a real person by the name of Josiah Henson, who began the Dawn Institute. And this is huge. If you go into Canada today, if you go into the community of Dresden, just outside of it, you can actually go visit the real Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is Josiah Henson's family cabin.
He is an extraordinary figure, isn't he? I mean, so charismatic, a man of such creativity and skill and courage. I mean, what a marvelous person this is.
Well, all those attributes and more have to be credited to Josiah Henson. He escaped with his four children, carrying two of them on his back. He became a very instrumental in establishing this manual training school in Dawn called the British American Institute. He certainly became a leader of his community. He was a Prince Hall Mason. He was a minister. He actually eventually met Queen Victoria. He was certainly the prototype for a black man, the likes of which, when Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, Southern slave owners almost refused to believe that such a black man could exist. And this was some of the outrage when she wrote her book, is that she was giving humanistic, family-loving traits to black people that heretofore had not been acknowledged in black folks.
Hmm. How many communities are we ultimately talking about that are settled in Canada? And how many of them were ultimately thriving communities that lived on for many years?
Well, we're not talking about that many. We're talking about four or five, maybe six, and I mentioned those in the book.
Right.
There were other settlements that I don't go into because of time and interest and other reasons. But I centered this book only on the Ontario region for the most part. But we have the Dawn settlement, we have Wilberforce, but we also have one of the most successful settlements, and that was the Buxton settlement, or the Elgin Association. And that one was based, again, right outside, about 60 miles up from Detroit, and it still exists today. The community of North Buxton still is there today, and the descendants are still farming the lands and living on lands that their ancestors lived on from the time of the first settlement there in 1849.
Hmm. Jacqueline Tobin is the author of From Midnight to Dawn, The Last Tracks of the Underground Railroad, published by Anchor Books. This conversation was recorded back in 2008. I'm Gregory Berg, and the time is 8:38. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. Here's part two.
We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a very talented Swedish writer by the name of Martin Österdahl. He's actually been an award-winning director for a number of years, but now is taking on new undertakings as a writer, and very obviously a gifted one. The book that we're going to be talking about, a novel called Ask No Mercy, the first in a series of books around a character named Max Enger, has been a huge success in Sweden and in areas beyond, and as a matter of fact is soon going to be transformed into a major television series. And one of the things that makes this book particularly interesting is because it largely involves the nation of Russia,
where the author, Martin Østerdahl, spent some years studying. And so he has long been intrigued by the nation of Russia, and particularly the volatile period of the mid to late 1990s. And that is the time period in which this thriller is based. And this novel has recently been translated into English and is now available to American readers. And I'm excited about the possibility of talking now with Martin Østerdahl about Ask No Mercy, published by Amazon. And Martin Østerdahl, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, tell us about your career ahead of being a writer. Explain to us the kind of things that you have directed and the ways in which that earlier work has led to this new undertaking for you.
Well, I started out working in media and media management, and then I started producing television shows. And most of the television shows I've been involved in have been entertainment shows, so music, big sort of music-based entertainment shows, which, you know, quite different from writing novels, obviously. But I've also worked a lot with as a director of television at the national TV station SVT in Sweden, and of course overseeing production of all sorts of genre. And I guess that at the bottom of it all lies a great interest and passion for storytelling. And, you know, no matter what kind of TV shows or books you produce, the heart of the matter is always a great story.
Hmm. So what was it that brought you to Russia, where you did some studying? First of all, what age were you at the time, and what exactly were you studying, and why in Russia?
Well, my first experience with the East was when I was at school. As a young boy, I was fortunate enough to go to a special music school. So I did a lot of singing. I sang at the Royal Opera House in Stockholm, and we traveled with the choir, with the opera choir, to behind the Iron Curtain, as it was at the time. So I got to tour in East Berlin, in the Czech Republic, and in Hungary, places like that, which was something that not many people in my age was able to do, obviously, because during this time, Europe was sealed. In that part of Europe was sealed. Europe divided in two halves. But I was brought up in Sweden, which belonged to the western side, and I also grew up in England, where my father lives. So I was very, very amazed by how different life was behind the Iron Curtain. And when I was there, we were taught from an early age that this was the enemy. This was, you know, the opposition in the Cold War. But the people that I met were so fascinating, so full of life, and so incredibly hospitable to us. And so it woke my curiosity to try and understand, you know, how can we be so different, but at the same time so similar? So I think from that very early age, I decided that I had to try and understand all of this and try and understand Europe.
Hmm. So what was the experience like to actually go to school for a time in Russia, and I believe finish your master's thesis, actually?
Mm. Yeah, so I decided there and then that if you're going to understand, you know, Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia, you probably need to learn the language, and you need to spend some time in Russia. So at university level, I studied Russian, and I spent some time in Moscow first and then in St. Petersburg. And that was the part where the book is based, which was mid-90s, 1996, to be more precise, was the time of the watershed presidential election when Boris Yeltsin managed, against all odds, to come back from a pretty bleak position in the opinion polls to win the election. You know, this was a time when Russia was pretty much lawless, and there was a lot of tension in the air, and everyone actually believed that the Communist Party, then led by a man called Zhuganov, was going to win that election. So everyone was sort of fearing that this very brief period of openness and democracy was going to end after only 5 years. But somehow Yeltsin managed to win with the help of Western forces, but also with the help of the oligarchs. And this, of course, is the social sort of backdrop to Ask No Mercy. And there's a lot of interesting things happened in this election that actually hasn't been written about so much. So I was fortunate enough to be there in St. Petersburg when it happened, and later on I decided to write this down in the novel.
Hmm. So exactly how long has this novel, in a sense, been percolating, been sort of beneath the surface of your life, sort of waiting to finally be shaped?
Quite a long time, to be honest. It started out, actually, when I lived in New York for a while, and I lived there during the attacks of World Trade Center, 9/11.
Wow.
So my first attempt at writing this story actually started the days after 9/11, when I lived in my Manhattan apartment, and I had experienced the terrible catastrophe firsthand. I mean, we lived close to World Trade Center. We lived beneath the line that was sealed off for a few weeks and months after. And everything stopped. Everything stopped in New York, people just, especially us expats from the UK or from Sweden, we just sort of, we sat in cafes and talked and tried to understand what had happened. And for me, I felt this great urge to just sit down and write, to try and understand what was going on. And my thoughts traveled back to Russia and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, because that, up until 9/11, was the biggest sort of historic event of my life, and it certainly formed my upbringing and my understanding of the world. So there I was on Manhattan writing about the collapse of the Soviet Union, pretty much, and that turned out to eventually, 15 years later, it became Ask No Mercy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Martin Østerdahl, and his first novel is indeed titled Ask No Mercy. It was a enormous bestseller in Sweden and has been published elsewhere as well. It is just now published in a new English translation by Peter Sean Woltemad and available now to American listeners. So I want you to talk about your main character, Max Unger. And one of the things I also want to confess as an out-of-touch American is that as I'm kind of thinking about the life of this man named Max Unger, it makes me realize that I think most Americans never stop to think about a nation like Sweden being engaged in intelligence and counterintelligence and espionage and that kind of thing. I think we often tend to think of that as something that only the superpowers are engaged in. I mean, not that Sweden isn't a perfectly significant country in some respects, but it's not a superpower in that respect, of course. What can you tell us about this kind of activity in a nation like Sweden?
Well, I mean, to Swedes, and in Sweden, especially Russia, has always been considered the arch enemy, and this goes back way, way back into history. If you take Max Unger, the protagonist of the book, he's raised on an island called Arholma outside of Stockholm, in the archipelago of Stockholm. Stockholm is surrounded by about 30,000 islands, and Arholma is one of them. If you go to this island today, you'll find that at the northern tip of it, there's a huge military base. It's abandoned now, but it's a gigantic sort of construction inside the mountain. And at the top of the mountain is a huge cannon pointing to the east. And it's still there if you want to go and see it.
Wow.
And also, if you walk around the cliffs of this island, you'll find inscriptions in the stones from the time when Peter the Great invaded the island in the 1700s and put the whole island on fire. So to the people on the coast, on the east coast of Sweden especially, there's always been an awareness that on the other side of that sea is the gigantic country of Russia, and it's always in our history been our arch enemy. So we've always had to keep an eye. There's a saying that goes around in those areas that if you're from there, you always sleep with one eye open, and it's always open to the east.
Mm. So one way in which the nation of Sweden has its collective eye open to the east is through a think tank called Vector, which does perpetual research on Russia in order to understand what they might be doing. And your main character works for Vector, as does a woman who eventually disappears. Tell us more about their relationships and the mysterious circumstances of her disappearance.
Well, they're a couple, and they, I think they were united in many things. But one of the things that they really both stand very firmly for is the freedom of everyone to live a free life. And Pashi, as she's called, the Russian girl that Max is in love with, she is from Russia. She's from an area of the Ukraine, actually called. She's a Tatar, so she's in a minority, a Russian minority. And of course, in recent years, when this book was actually eventually published, what happened was that Putin and Russia invaded that part of the Ukraine and reclaimed it as Russian territory. This is Crimea, as I'm sure you're aware. And she has a personal history of having her grandfather being taken away one morning by Stalin. As so many minorities were, to be deported somewhere to do pretty much slave labor in some gigantic infrastructure project somewhere in the Soviet Empire, and this is something that has really plagued her upbringing, and she's fighting for the freedom of all Russian people. And in that, she's very much united in Max, because Max has a similar kind of background with a very mysterious family situation. He doesn't know who his grandparents are. All he knows is that his father was placed on this small island called Arholma outside of Stockholm. But beyond that, he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know who his grandparents were and how it happened that his father was placed there as a foster child. So he's trying to sort of dig into the past and find out who he really is, and Pashi is doing the same. So that those two things really sort of unite the two of them. And of course, at the outset of this book, Max has tried to dig deeper into what happened to his father and his grandparents. And as he does that, suddenly Pashi goes missing in St. Petersburg. Because she's working for Vector in St. Petersburg, and he's working in Stockholm. So he sets off to try and find her. And obviously, he senses that there might be a connection to his mysterious family past and the reasons why she has been kidnapped.
Right. And, of course, it's especially frightening and difficult for him to be undertaking this search in a place like Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially at the time, because there's no one you can trust. It's not like you can't go to the Swedish consulate or the Swedish embassy. You can't go to the police. You know, heaven forbid. So basically, you have to go and look for yourself, and that's what he does.
Mm. I love the way that journey is painted with ominous signs at every turn. It's marvelously crafted. I want to be sure to ask you a question, kind of on behalf of all Americans. When we think about a nation like Russia, which of course is very much in the news and has been over the last couple of years, chiefly for the very very clear evidence indicating that Russian operatives were very directly involved in our most recent presidential election, and of course certain matters that are currently under investigation. I think Russia, as you said at the outset, is one of those nations that has a certain sort of mystique about it, and we view them very warily and also tend to view them with grave suspicion, yet fascination and intrigue. Mm. How do you think, how would you advise us as Americans to sort of think about the nation of Russia? And how different is the Russia of today from the Russia that you are describing in your novel?
Wow, that's a big question. I think as far as advice is concerned, I think the picture that's often portrayed of Russia in media is a simplified one. I think what one has to realize that Russia is an enormous country. It's pretty much, you know, like a world in itself. And there are so many different Russias, so many different Russian people as well. And of course, I think to anyone who really wants to increase their knowledge and understanding of Russia and the world, history is a good place to look and to try and look deeper than what you might find in the daily newspapers. And also in popular culture, you quite often tend to find quite sort of single dimension descriptions of Russians, but it's a very complicated country. The time of the 90s, in which my book is taking place, was a very positive time period in many ways, because, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union and with Gorbachev, who started it all with his perestroika and his glasnost, the openness to the West, I think we all felt a sense of opening and a sense of near, you know, a nearing of Russia and Europe and the West, which was, it was really a time of great optimism, but also great concern. I mean, in this part of the world, in Sweden and Scandinavia, we were very concerned that the Russians would just, you know, come in hundreds of thousands and leave this poor country that had collapsed and immigrate to our countries in huge volumes. Of course, that never happened. And the reason for that is that the Russians are very proud and they love their homeland. They love their country and their culture very, very much. And they consider themselves to be a high culture, you know, one of the high cultures of the world. And the fascination with Russia is something that we all in Sweden we very much feel. It's not only that we fear them and consider them the arch enemy, we're also very fascinated of their high culture. They're enormously successful and prolific in sports, in all forms of arts and entertainment and literature and so on. So there's a lot to admire about the Russians, and they are very patriotic. So they never did leave the Russian soil in any great numbers, and they do love Mother Russia, and there are a lot of explanations for why, but the culture is very different from the rest of Europe.
Hmm. Well, it's a beautifully crafted novel. I am most impressed. As I read it, I kept sort of exclaiming to myself in wonder that this is your first novel, and clearly all of your work as a director over the years has taught you a lot about what it means to tell a good story, what it means to entertain, and your novel is certainly all of that and more. I assume you are very excited at the prospect of it taking shape as a series for television as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that is a dream come true. Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
The novel, again, is Ask No Mercy. It is published by Amazon Running, and the author, Martin Østerdahl. Martin Østerdahl, I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you, and I wish you well with all of your future endeavors.
Thank you very much.
Monday on The Morning Show, you will hear in its entirety an interview that I aired a portion of on Wednesday with a woman named Dominique Pichet. She grew up in Kenosha in really abject poverty and spent a large portion of her childhood essentially homeless. but she went on to graduate from Bradford High School and then Carthage College, and is soon to be a fully certified psychologist, hoping to set up private practice here in Kenosha and to serve underserved populations. She is speaking at the Kenosha Civil War Museum Tuesday evening as part of their Courageous Conversations series. But you can hear my conversation with her in its entirety